The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Confidence is up, but markets are down for the week. Election upset in Japan. Financials shine after the Fed gives the green light. Got a short week coming for markets, and our guest today is John Markman of Markman Capital Insight. All this and much more on episode number 516 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very happy 4th of July, Independence Day. Happy birthday, America. And hello to all of you. Hopefully having a wonderful time at maybe a barbecue, an outing, a family gathering, something to have some fun on this weekend, this elongated weekend where we have, works out perfectly, didn't it? Worked out perfectly where we have the weekend off, half day for markets on Monday. Maybe some of you are off from work as well. And on top of that, off on Tuesday as the national holiday. Well, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me and taking the time out of your busy schedule to catch up on some of the insight on markets and news and what's going on around the world with regards to money and finance. Here we spend some time each and every week looking at what's going on and learning a bit about money and finance, investments, markets, stocks, and bonds, and ETFs, mutual funds, and all the things that go into the game of investing. We have a great guest with us today. We'll talk about that in a bit. But I guess, you know, we're going to be talking, I'll tell you what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about artificial intelligence and robotics. I'm not sure how you feel about that, what your thoughts are on the subject. I have some mixed feelings. I got to tell you something. You know, we have the idea of this wonderful opportunity for technology to advance us into the next stage of something in the future, some opportunity that we get in order to benefit our lives, possibly have the benefit of gains in things like the productivity of not only life, but business. But again, I have some mixed feelings. The whole idea of what happens to jobs? What happens to personal relationships for people, where we have now, instead of people picking up a phone, they're texting and they're talking on Twitter and on Facebook and on Snapchat? And what about this whole idea of technology overload, where people are checking on their social media more than they are worried about what's going on in their day-to-day lives and business, and productivity falls dramatically? I mean, there's some positive thoughts, yes. I mean, clearly this weekend we saw that in the area of healthcare, I don't know if you saw this article, but in the area of healthcare, and it was just announced this weekend, there are biotech companies that are now embracing the use of artificial intelligence and supercomputers in order to find drugs that will cure many different diseases. They're using the abilities and the vast power of computers to model what the reaction to various cells and molecules are in order to fast track the development of some disease-fighting, drug-fighting diseases. Now, that's pretty cool. Anyway, what are your thoughts? You can always send me a note. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew section at the top there and simply send me a note or a question or a comment or a review. If you want to say something nice about the show or something not nice about the show, we'll take that too. Creative criticism and constructive criticism are always something that we look for. So you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. By the way, on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, you can also find all about our various strategies that we have for clients. A lot of people very recently, I think maybe because the market, they're getting a little nervous with some of the toppiness or potential valuation of the market. They've been a lot. I could see recently there's been a lot more activity, people requesting information and opening accounts over on the Disciplined Investor for the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. and also the global allocation. So that's something that I've definitely noticed an uptick in the last month and a half that people have been going there. So if you want more information about that, you can find that also on the first page of the Disciplined Investor. Just scroll down a bit. And there's actually a virtual tour, a video that explains everything about the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, where we look at a variety of different tactics in order to run the portfolio and manage the portfolio from core strategies. We incorporate our Arrow algorithm, as well as some hedging that goes on there too. So check that out over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. All right, well, let's do a recap. Let's kind of look at what happened last week. What do we see? Well, it was odd that markets were looking to open the week higher, but ended the week down. As a matter of fact, the weakest area we saw was the NASDAQ with about a 2% loss for the week. The S&P was down about a little more than 0.5%, and the Dow is off about just about 0.25%. The big winners on the week were financials, clearly, where we saw that the Fed gave the green light, the result of the capital studies and what's going on with banks. Pretty much all banks across the board that they had, I think it was 35 banks that they have the results for, all passed. All allowed to now increase their dividends and provide share buybacks. And boy, did they. I mean, once this report came out and the results were in, we saw massive dividend hikes by banks and share buybacks. As a matter of fact, the buybacks ranged, I saw 6 to 8% was probably the average. 6 to 8% of the market capitalization of the various banks are now on plan to be bought back by the various banks. And dividend hikes, yeah. I saw a couple of banks at like the 50% number, hiking their dividend 50%. So, of course, that works with the share buyback because they can offset some of the cost of the share buyback with the dividend. But Citigroup was, I think, clearly one of the biggest winners on the week. Now at a multi-year high, trading at $66. And I think if you look at the longer-term chart, you'll see that the split-adjusted level pre-crisis was $550. So a long way to go, a long way for Citigroup. But they did a massive buyback as well. JP Morgan, we saw some big numbers out of them. And again, these dividends. So people were pretty excited about this and saying, you know, maybe the financials finally, especially with the comments from the Fed chief Janet Yellen that I'm paraphrasing, but she said something to the effect of, we will never see another financial crisis in our lifetimes, which got a lot of people happy and elated, saying, oh, finally, we're in a position that we don't have to worry about what happened back in, you know, mid-2000 with the financial crisis and the banks faltering. It's over. It's never going to happen again. And some people saying, oh, my, those kind of comments are hallmarks of times of excess exuberance and very wrong thinking. I mean, go back in history and see a lot of examples of this when there is the proclamation that you'll never see this kind of situation again, and we've solved all the problems and we'll never see a market go from trough to peak and peak to trough where we're going to, you know, kill that whole top and bottom part. It's just going to be smooth sailing for some time. And what happens? That's pretty much the time that people start saying, oh, that's it. That's the peak. It's done. Those comments are really, you know, everything cycles. As a matter of fact, in this quarterly commentary that we write for our clients each and every quarter at Horowitz & Company, I talked about the cycles. You know, the sun rises, the sun sets, the moon comes up, the moon goes down. You know, we see that there's an ebb and flow of the tide. And you know, just like with all of that, the cycles that we see, the economic cycle also has similar patterns. Now, sometimes the economic cycles can be elongated because not a natural occurrence. There's things that come into play in this that will possibly extend or in some instances will actually cut short some of the economic expansion. But there is that general rule that the economy will cycle as well. And to try to think that there is not going to be that cycle in the future, I think is very wishful thinking at best. So Anyway, we did see that financials had a great week last week. Technology was the worst hit overall. After we get through with a discussion and commentary with our guest, I'm going to come back. I'm going to talk about what happened in Europe last week that was, I think, really interesting. What's going on with the Fed funds and some of the economics that we should be looking for next week. But what happened in Europe on the heels of the commentary from Janet Yellen and some of the recent movement on the Fed funds and what's happening with the bond portfolio of the Fed and how they're looking to, you know, start slowing down the buys and actually liquidating that portfolio. You know, the central bankers are getting a little bit, I think, they're getting inebriated with their own abilities. Anyway, I think it's kind of cool. We're going to talk about some AI. Let's get right to our guest. And our guest today is John Markman, an old friend, a good friend of mine. He is the head of Markman Capital Insight, the founder. They write some just terrific, some of the best stock options and futures newsletters you're going to find out there. We'll make sure to put all of the links to how to get your samples and subscriptions to that on the disciplinedinvestor.com website under this particular episode. John, how are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You know, one of the things that I do, I follow your Twitter feed, you know that, and you're talking a lot about this whole area of, you talk about a lot of things, but one of the things you've been talking about is artificial intelligence, or AI, as we call it. And I wanted to share a story with you really quickly about my recent experience with, we'll call it artificial intelligence. So I was applying for some insurance on geico.com, and there's a little box in the corner right that says, you know, if you have any questions, just ask Kate. I'm like, okay, well, fine. So I'm going along doing my thing, and I don't have any questions, but then all of a sudden I'm like, you know, I have a question. So I asked Kate, and I got a great answer. I'm like, oh, that was good. She's really good, this Kate. And then I had another question, and Kate answered with a really great answer. I'm thinking, God, she's good. And I realized at that moment, this was not a human being. This was a bot, an artificial intelligence program that was well-programmed to efficiently answer my questions in a way that wasn't machine-like. And that's some of the stuff that's going on with AI, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that these human-like bots are the way that individuals are going to interact with artificial intelligence first. You know, AI it's a big buzzword now, but all it means is it's all about the intelligence shown by machines, okay? So these are, by machines, I mean, it could be a device, like your smartphone. Mm-hmm. These are devices that perceive their environment and then take actions that maximize for success at some goal. So in the instance of the bot that was helping Geico, you know, this software wasn't mad at her boss, wasn't thinking about a fight she'd had with her boyfriend or husband. She was just maximized for efficiently answering your question. And if you think about it, you know, you thought that she was even better than a human. And that's exactly the way that an artificial intelligence should seem, you know, when it's used effectively. A great example is, you know, the artificial intelligence that's going to be driving, so to speak, autonomous cars. Mm-hmm. So we all know that humans can drive cars. We've been doing it, you know, since the early 1900s. But machines can do it better because they're not distracted.
Right. They're not reading their cell phones. They're not having a fight. They're not trying to change the channel for the radio. They're not worried about the guy next to him cutting him off, doesn't get angry and start, you know, speeding up towards them, giving them the finger.
They're exactly right. They are machines that are optimized for success at a goal. And the goal is to drive you from place to place, not to show that you're macho, not to provide a platform for eating your sandwich while you drive, not as a platform for listening to music.
Right.
Just they want to maximize on getting to the place that you're going efficiently.
I mean, I can see, by the way, some of these things being really beneficial and not displacing necessarily the human, right? But enhancing the human experience. That's really the goal of this, right?
Well, if the great example again is the artificial intelligence that's going to be used in autonomous cars. So the time that you spend behind the wheel, some people say they enjoy it, right? But they'll enjoy it a lot more if they can divorce themselves while they're in the car from the transportation aspects of the car if they can divorce the transportation aspect from the attention that's required to drive effectively. When the car takes over, instead of focusing on the road and watching all the traffic signals and while listening to the radio and keeping the kids from fighting, you'll be able to you'll get to your goal much more effectively and safely.
And safely, yeah, safely.
So, you know, humans can do these jobs, but they're not. We're not as good at them as machines. And machines will then allow us, will free us up to do things that we enjoy more. So instead of driving, focusing on the road during your 45-minute commute, you can watch a Netflix show, or you can, use the internet to Google answers to questions that you might have for a meeting that you have coming up. So machines will free us up to be better humans.
So there's definitely that set, by the way, John, there's definitely that set of AI, machine, robotics that enhances the human experience. And I can definitely see that with certain things like autonomous driving and a variety of other, things. I mean, elevators, for that matter, are autonomous elevators these days, right? You used to have an elevator guy that would take you up and down the various things. Now you just push a button and they're all programmed into certain banks to efficiently put an elevator at the top floor, the bottom floor, and all that. I mean, think about that. That's the most simplest form of it's vertical transportation versus horizontal.
I totally agree with you. I think elevators are really a great example. And, the elevators in my office building, One Union Square in Seattle, are really advanced. They actually know how many people are left in the building at various floors because they know how many people have taken the elevator up. So they know how many people are left to take the elevator back down. So in the evening, they actually hover around certain floors, the upper floors, waiting for those people that they know are there to take them down.
Well, that's kind of spooky. It's good for fires, I guess, too. You know who's in what floor. You don't take an elevator in the fire, but I'm saying if any emergency, that at least you have some kind of placement. I mean, I've been into some really cool computers, like computerized elevators in Manhattan that are just something's going on. You know something's going on very cool behind the scenes with all these elevators. But
I really feel like when I take the elevator at my office, I feel like my elevator gets me.
you got a personal bond with your elevator, huh?
I do.
Yeah.
But it's not just elevators and automobiles. You look at what General Electric is doing and infusing artificial intelligence into all of its machines. If you think about a turbine or a chemical process like for desalinating water or whatever that might be. For years, there have been analog chips providing that act as sensors to tell you how hot the temperature is or how much the acidity is in a particular chemical process. And they just show information on gauges. But as General Electric becomes more savvy about artificial intelligence, these machines are not just displaying information about their processes, they're actually able to take action on those process changes themselves. That's the difference.
Now, so we see GE. We know that companies like Mobileye and Tesla and Google and Apple and to name just a few are involved with this whole autonomous and for that matter Siri and you have Alexa with Amazon. So I see all that, but when we talk about, let's skip over to robotics. So not just necessarily making our lives easier by doing some menial tasks that will help us free us some time. What about this whole robotics area that, for example, I always cite the issue of, you have Amazon warehouses that used to have pickers that would pull out various boxes to complete an order and send it out. A lot of that is fully automated and through robots these days. Is that area going to displace a tremendous amount of workers? Does that have the capacity to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. Machines are much better at picking and sorting and just dealing with the kind of boxes that you see at a warehouse. They're a much more efficient workforce and they're a safer workforce, and they will allow companies like Amazon to push down prices. If you think about it, on the one hand, humans are being displaced by the machines, but on the other hand, we're getting all the devices and services and products that we like at lower prices. So there's a trade-off.
So how I know we have a 3% unemployment rate, and the whole idea bring jobs back. But it seems to me that, you know, if we do bring jobs back here to the United States in the areas that are lacking, such as manufacturing, which has been an area that we've exported for so many years, I mean, is there going to be really those jobs created again, or is that just fantasy land?
It's fantasy land.
Oh, okay. You know, all right, good. I'm glad we agree on that.
I don't have the solution. I don't know exactly what people are going to be doing in the future in terms of people who used to be factory workers had either a modest skill or even a important skill, such as welding. What they're going to do in the future as far as how they're going to interact with the public in order to have a job. Because, you know, almost all of the more menial jobs that you might get after you lost your job at a factory, you know, are also being automated. So this is definitely a public policy issue, and I think that this is an area where politicians should be having a high-minded discussion with the public rather than some of the other things they get distracted with.
It's interesting because for years the Fed discounted the whole idea of employment gains or employment losses in the future with any kind of robotics or any kind of technology, talking about how, you know, technology is actually going to create a tremendous amount of jobs. And there's some statistics that are out there saying that over the next, I think, dozen years or so, that artificial intelligence and automation will actually bring $17 billion worth of potential gains to the economy in the U.S., which I don't really understand how that works. Maybe it could be in savings, but then I would think that what's going to happen is that those savings will come from the repositioning of a lot of people from jobs. You know, and don't forget that companies, if they're going to find the cheapest solution to get things done, right? That's the way companies work. You know,
that's what their shareholders and stakeholders want them to do.
Right. I mean, they want them to do it until it affects them personally in a negative way. Right. So if I'm a shareholder, I'm glad my company is doing well. But if somehow I work for that company and now I'm displaced by that, now I'm pissed off. There's a lot of really great examples about this. So we know some of the high level AI that's going on, right? We all have heard of IBM's Watson, and we've heard about some really cool ways that they're doing working in the healthcare field to try to solve and to bring together records and possible diagnosis.
And their AI machines are doing a fantastic job of doing diagnoses.
Right. Tremendous.
You know, one of the main jobs of doctors, for centuries, you know, has been, you know, figuring out exactly what ails a patient if it's not obvious around the surface. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that AI is, you know, really great at sifting through answers, a series of questions that are posed to patients, and coming up with diagnoses and prescriptions.
So we know some of the high level ones, right? We know the names like the Google and the and even Alibaba is now getting into this whole game. Who are some of the ones under the radar?
The fascinating thing is that about that question is that there really aren't a lot of small public companies that are involved in AI that you can go out and buy today. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is the large companies like Amazon and Google and Microsoft and SAP in Germany, they've been really, really effective at spotlighting the best engineers coming out of the universities like MIT, Stanford, and Carnegie Mellon, and either hiring them directly out of school or buying their companies after their young companies after they've been, you know, private for a couple of years. So the large companies are sucking up all the talent and all of the smart ideas before it gets to the stage where you can buy them as a $500 million public company or $1 billion public company. So this is really a problem. But the other thing is, this is a problem in terms of investors trying to find smaller mid-cap companies in this space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that artificial intelligence, to be done right, requires a vast amount of data.
Yeah.
Just to analyze. Okay. You need to see humans doing or machines doing hundreds of billions of operations or actions a day in order to sift through exactly how to interact with that better. And it turns out that the large companies like Amazon, through its website, and Google, through its search, are the companies that are most capable of collecting all the data that makes artificial intelligence work. And that's why, you know, I really think that if you want to take advantage of AI in the public markets, you all roads lead to Amazon and Google.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Microsoft's far behind this curve, right?
Well, they're not really behind, but I don't think they're as far advanced as Amazon and Google are, because they have another mission, right? Their mission primarily is to provide operating systems. And,
what about Facebook?
And
Facebook
office also, software.
Facebook must be way up.
Oh yeah,
on that.
I should have mentioned Facebook is also very advanced in artificial intelligence. Some smaller companies that I like, there's a chip company named NVIDIA.
Yeah, small one.
I'm sure I've been talking about them on your shows for years. They started off being the best maker of graphics cards for PCs. Then they evolved to being the best graphics cards makers for video games, which require a very high level of computing power. And led by their founder, they moved into creating chips that are optimized for artificial intelligence operations and autonomous driving and data centers. And so that makes NVIDIA, which is still it's a large cap company, but it's not as large as the majors.
And by the way, might I say NVIDIA still, also still with their the latest Bitcoin mining cards.
Yeah, I mean, the chips can be oriented towards doing a variety of specialized activities. And NVIDIA has been used for Bitcoin mining. I think that is a little over, that aspect of their business is overdone. But
yeah.
In terms of artificial intelligence operations and data center use, you're going to find that NVIDIA has a very, very large runway in front of them.
A couple of other
companies in the space I like is a mid-cap company called John Bean Technologies, symbol is JBT. They are a specialist in food handling and cargo handling machines like airports and food processing operations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're moving more and more into creating the software and the artificial intelligence that make these machines work. So John Bean Technology, it's an interesting company. It's been successful for many years, and yet it's still, I think it's only about a $4 or $5 billion company.
Mm.
And it's just breaking out of a long consolidation. So that's something that people can look at.
Mm-hmm.
In another sphere, I think Domino's Pizza. I think of Domino's as a software company that happens to sell pizza.
Yeah, lousy pizza, in my opinion, but yes, a software company, I agree.
And Domino's is surprisingly still a relatively small company in the big picture. It's only, a $9.5 billion market cap.
But they sell pizza. Pizza.
Yeah, but they sell pizza really efficiently and effectively, and they managed to cut costs just relentlessly. There's a lot of debate as to whether they're a good employer. A lot of employees and franchisees have complained about them, but as far as shareholders are concerned, they've done a tremendous job of melding technology with consumer demand.
Yeah, they sure have. I mean, I think. By the way, I do agree with you that they have the software down, at least at this stage.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, if you think about getting pizza, there will be a pizza man at your door in about 15 minutes.
I'm hoping pepperoni.
As far as small caps are concerned, I do know one small cap / micro cap that recently went public. I don't usually like to recommend micro caps or small cap companies because there's a lot that can go wrong.
Yeah,
but there's a company called Veritone, Veritone. Symbol is VERI. It's about $180 million market cap. It came public about 2.5 or 3 months ago. The guys behind Veritone are a couple of serial entrepreneurs who have sold numerous ad networks and other companies to the likes of CMGI and Google over the years. And their latest idea is to create an AI platform an open AI platform that they can provide to companies. And revenue is not that great right now, but I think that they have if they play their cards right, they should have a a pathway towards being at least a $500 million company in the next couple of years.
Wow, pretty impressive. I mean, I guess it's like the problem with any kind of open, I guess you said calling open source, is that, you know, it's a little bit tough to get the thing going at the beginning because it's open source and there's not a lot. But once you kind of, I guess, get that thing right, then it's sellable.
Well, I mean, you look at Red Hat, right? I mean,
well,
people said the same thing about Red Hat.
Right.
I mean, how could you provide services for the use of Linux when Linux is open source? Anybody can go and, you know, download it from, from GitHub or any place else. But it turns out that Red Hat has done a tremendous job of selling services on top of that open platform.
Yep.
And I think that companies like Veritone, if they're able to execute on their plan, will be seen in much the same way.
That's very interesting. We're going to wrap it up there. John Markman, Markman Capital Insight. Again, he has all sorts of wonderful ideas. He puts out a daily newsletter on a few different topics, also stock-related options, futures. You really have to take a look. He has an eloquent writing style. I read his stuff all the time. I think very much, you know what's nice about your newsletters, John?
What's that?
Is that it's not, you don't feel like you're being punched in the face, somebody trying to tout something to you. Do you know what I'm talking about? Those newsletters that come out and they're like, they're hawking you about a stock and this hot. It's like, well, why are they hawking me so much about this stock? It's like, what's in it for them? This is more of a high-level discussion about, you know, certain areas using a variety of techniques and strategies with backtesting, et cetera, that, you know, in some, not all, but some of these stock-related types of portfolios that you develop that really, I think, gives a thought-provoking and information, and then, you know, use it or if you want or don't use it if you don't want, but at least, you know, here's all the information in front of you versus some of these newsletters that are, you know, 22 pages long and 20 pages of it is a hype about something, some crazy stories that go on.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What I'm gathering you're saying is that I have some real intelligence in my newsletters as opposed to that artificial intelligence.
Oh,
who needs
yes,
it, right?
Exactly. Bah, humbug.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew.
All right, I'll talk to
great
you.
Great to be on your show, as always.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Now, we'll put a list of all the names of the stocks that John mentioned on the website under this show episode, on the show notes, as we call it. You can go find out information about all of our guests. As a matter of fact, you know, there's one thing that's really cool that we recently put up on the website. If you go to podcast episodes on the top left, there's a drop-down menu on the top navigation there. You can drop that down. You can actually type in the name of a guest or a stock for that matter, but a name of a guest and see all the shows that they appeared on in the past to give you an easy way to categorize, itemize, and to figure out who's on what they're saying, the stocks they mentioned, and all that. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check that out. That's one of the coolest things I think we added recently, a way to sort through all the, I mean, we've had 500 episodes. And with 500 episodes, think about probably 450 guests, maybe. There's been some duplicates, so maybe let's call it 350. Now I think about that. I never really said it like that before and thought about this before. We had probably 350 different guests on our show over the years, providing us with insights in all areas of economics, stocks, finance, financial planning, college planning, really kind of a cool thing. But here's the thing. There's now a really easy way to find out when they were on, what they talked about, and information about the show. So you can go over to there, just click on the podcast episodes top left. It will give you a really good way to sort through everything, either in chronological order or by stock mentioned or by guest that was on the show. And like I said, we're going to put the actual stocks that we mentioned. We always do this at the bottom of the list or somewhere inside of the show notes for this episode. Well, before we went to our guest and talked with John, I had mentioned that we were going to talk about Europe a little bit. Now, last week, it was pretty fascinating that Mario Draghi comes out. He's the ECB chair and the chief, the head, the big kahuna. He comes out and he's going to talk about, a variety of different items. And he started talking about the strength of Europe and how the growth has started to take hold. And there was some inferences in his commentary about that the you know, he's thinking that maybe we can start scaling back on some of the stimulus, the bond buying program, the quantitative easing they're doing. The euro shot up from the 111 level, 1.11 level. And, you know, it was off to the races for the day. And there was some commentary, oh my gosh, if he's going to actually start slowing down, we better start selling these bonds. And we saw that the euro bond rates really rocketed higher for the day. It was a pretty interesting day overall. And that was not taken well by markets, you know, because everybody wants stimulus, of course. The more, the better. And just a day later, we've seen this before, by the way, just a day later, the ECB is out with comments saying that the markets misinterpreted Draghi's remarks, walking back what Draghi had said just a day earlier. I mean, this is the way they operate, right? So they send up a trial balloon. They see how markets react. Markets did not like what he said at all. So the next day they come out and they say, oh, no, 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 no. Oh, you silly, silly markets. This is not at all what he meant. And they try to reverse what he had said to try to calm down markets and to try to stop the acceleration of the euro, which, by the way, ended the week at 114 after there was further commentary about potentially constraining some of the stimulus. Now, what I think is going on here, just let's think about this. They see that the U.S. markets did well, that bond prices stayed low, and actually we saw people running towards bonds after a number of rate hikes by the Fed and even discussion by the Fed of slowing down their quantitative easing program and actually unloading some of the bonds that they have on their balance sheets. And the ECB looked on and said, wow, look at that. They're increasing rates. They're slowing down stimulus. They're talking up a big game here. And bonds were bought. I wonder if we could do the same because, you know, we want our bonds to be bought because, of course, they're holding a tremendous amount of bonds on their balance sheet, just as the Fed is. And they want to make sure that they maintain price stability with their bonds. So they thought they can get away with talking about how they are going to do similar things that the Fed did. And let's see how that plays out. So they send up this trial balloon and they didn't do well with it, at least that first day. Now, by the way, it didn't take just one comment or one economic data point on the U.S. to have bond traders decide they want to continue to buy bonds. That's not what happened. So if the ECB and Draghi and their whole gang thinks that one comment is going to need to be walked back because it had a negative effect on markets and on the euro and on their fixed income pricing, they're being very short-sighted. And that in a nutshell is the problem. That they're so concerned with interim daily moves on markets across the board, whether it's currency or equities or bonds, that they can't get out of their own way. They've stopped taking the long view by walking back comments a day after Draghi made them. I think it's very clear that they're very concerned about the day-to-day movement of markets. They won't get themselves out of it. And that is not their job. Although they've proclaimed, maybe not outwardly, but by action, that this is their job. And when you look at history and you look at what has gone on over the last 10 years and how the central banks have become so embroiled and part and parcel of the markets, you have to wonder when the hell they're going to finally realize that they really should step aside and let markets act naturally in order to have them reach their ultimate conclusion. And I think the U.S. Fed has done that to a degree. They're still meddling a lot, though. But I think they've realized that with a combination of some fiscal that will come naturally with the fact that they're pulling away, I think that things will get better. We did see several countries, as a matter of fact, India over the weekend, come out with a new tax reform plan. Talk in Germany over the weekend how that Schauble, he said, there is room. Let me see what he said. I'm trying to remember this article. He said, there's room for further cuts for German taxes, but after the 2020 election. So what I think there's a political statement trying to cement his place in history so that he can put the carrot out there, because we know that already with the Trump administration, the carrot has worked very well with thinking about there's going to be taxes sometime in the future. And investors are kind of, you know, still sniffing that it may not happen right now, but maybe it will happen next year. And if that does happen eventually, well, things will be good. And we're very happy to bid the prices of stocks up at this point. And, you know, at least we know that sometime in the future, this is going to happen. So by creating another carrot in Germany, I think that Schauble, I think his name is pronounced, is doing the same thing. And at the same time, he's doing it so that he can say after the election, in other words, vote me in and I'll make sure that there's some tax cuts that will come in. So this is all on the come. That's the bottom line on this. Crude oil, we mentioned, did have its third consecutive win of the week and of a few weeks, actually. It's been kind of doing a little bit better here. It started to start ticking up a little bit. It was up a little bit, about 1%. But the one thing I'll just mention on the Fed before we get to some of the economics that happened last week, as well as some of the economics that we'll be seeing for next week, is that Fed fund futures still point to a December FOMC meeting as the most likely time that the next rate hike announcement is going to happen. I think that we've gone from an implied probability of around 55% up from about just over 50%, 51%, I think it was, last week. So the potential for a final rate hike for the year in December, so we're going to skip a meeting, it looks like, has ticked up pretty dramatically. Now, some of that is going to depend on the economics that we've seen and that will come. So let's talk a little bit about that. Now, last week we saw that durable goods orders, which is, I think, a pretty reasonably high impacting economic series with regard to markets and the economy. We saw that it was down 1.1%, which was worse than last period, which was down 0.9%. If you strip out transportation, it was actually up 0.1%. So we did see that obviously there was an incredibly high impact on the durable goods orders with regard to, I guess it was pretty much the plane orders that we saw that ticked off a little bit. So when you look at this, there was an expectation of about 0.5%. So that came in light, and that was on Monday. Then we saw the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, and that came in at 5.7%. That's a gain over the last year, and that's been holding pretty well. The rise in the average home price in 20 cities has been actually holding on pretty well. Consumer confidence was at 118.9. We're definitely seeing, unquestionably seeing, a high level of consumer confidence, up from about 117. The wondrous thing here is that when you look at the rest of the numbers that we saw, what we saw during the week, for example, on Thursday we saw GDP. GDP came in at 1.4%. That's up from 1.2%, and that's good. We saw that the jobs number is still holding pretty well from a regard with initial claims. And then we saw personal income and personal spending come out. Now, I put this up on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz is the handle, just one word. And I put this chart up there because it was something I thought was very fascinating. Once again, we're seeing that personal income is rising. So it was 0.3% last month. It's up to about 0.4%. Nothing dramatic, but still it's on the uptick and things are looking better for personal income. Personal spending, on the other hand, went from a 0.4% increase in the prior month to May, where it's only 0.1%. Now, it's still positive. That's good. However, there's a major divergence going on with regard to three things. First, you have consumer confidence, which is still maintaining a pretty high level here. Then you have personal income, which is rising, which is probably helping the consumer confidence, and markets are probably helping consumer confidence, but yet somehow that's not translating into personal spending, where people are going out and spending money. Now, that could be for a few reasons. One, possibly confidence numbers on the current are not as high as the longer term. Okay, fine. People are somehow finding ways to save money on shopping. We know that that is very much indicative of and a result of, better said, a result of internet and comparison shopping. But sometimes we also see the situation as we're seeing here in a time when people are actually much more concerned than what the consumer confidence numbers are actually presenting. They're hunkering down. They're not spending on excess items. They're putting money into savings. They're making sure they have enough for the future without having any kind of massive increase in their cost today. I think it's a combination of a few of these things. I think there is some concern. I think some people are holding back. I think that the comparison shopping and the ability to find things cheaper is also helping. So I think there is a convergence in many of these things that are causing the consumer spending and the personal spending to actually drop. At the same time, this is why we're seeing such a low level of GDP. And again, that was my article that I wrote on The Disciplined Investor this week. It ain't going to get much better than this for GDP. I don't care what they say, what they're going to do. It's a matter of the of all the forces that are coming together. And even if we have more jobs, and even if we bring back some manufacturing somehow to the United States, I think that GDP sub 2% is here to stay for a while. Now let's talk for a moment about what's happening next week. Again, we have a short week. On Monday, the markets close at close early at, I think, 1 o'clock. On Tuesday, the equity markets are closed for the observance of the July 4th holiday. On Monday, we do see that we're going to have the ISM manufacturing index come out. Expectations are to see this at about 55.5, up from about 54.9. Construction spending, which was down last month, is expected to be a little bit higher for the month. And we're interested to see what's going to happen with auto and truck sales, which have been tailing off and slowing down dramatically over the last several months, as something that we talked about many, many months ago was the expansion of the loans, where you went from a average of 4 to 4.5 years to 7 years, was going to cannibalize their business. And that's happening here. So we'll see what the results are with auto and truck sales. Now, Tuesday, there are no economic results that will be announced. Wednesday, we'll see factory orders. not a really important number, but still they're looking at about a negative 0.5%. And we compare that to inventories and what's going on there and retail sales. And probably we know that factory orders are not going to be really spiking because personal spending's down, right? Makes sense. We have the minutes from the FOMC meeting. Now, usually what we've seen is that on a federal open market committee day, when you see minutes or announcement or a discussion or a talk or a rate decision, markets seem to react pretty significantly. Over the last few years, the initial reaction has often been reversed pretty quickly. And oftentimes you do see that with the FOMC meetings or any Fed meeting, that there is actually a positive bias towards the days because the Fed is usually either talking dovishly or hedging their hawkish discussion. On Thursday is where it starts to get interesting. On Thursday, we're going to have the ADP employment change. Expectations are for a gain of about 200,000 jobs after last month's whopping 253,000 job gain. We see ISM services index, the important part of the economy, looking to drop a little bit from about 56.9 to about 56.4. Then on Friday, we got the important ones. We got the payroll numbers. Expectations are for the unemployment rate to stay at 4.3%, a multi-decade low. The unemployment non-farm payrolls number to increase by about 185,000, up from 138,000. Remember, last month we did not see It was a surprisingly low number, and revisions were significant. I think an extra 70,000 people that were supposedly added to the payrolls over the prior 2 months actually weren't. Average hourly earnings coming out up about 0.3%, and the work week at 34.4 hours, which is standing pat on the same number. So I think when we look at next week in terms of importance, if you want to write this down, we have Monday, the ISM index. I think that's somewhat important. I think auto sales also are going to be very telling. Wednesday, not much except for the 2 o'clock FOMC meeting. Thursday, the ADP number, which is in advance, and a lot of people look at this as a precursor to the actual unemployment numbers, and the ISM services at 10 o'clock. And then Friday is going to be the important day. We'll see what's going on with the employment. That really does tell a lot about the economy. Now, I would be very surprised if we saw a very weak number again. However, I will share this with you. If we do see a very weak number this period, this is going to be a problem. For all the talk and all the, you know, the fist pumping and accolades about the economy expanding and jobs coming back and all that, if in fact we start to roll over at this point, that's going to be a big problem. If we see that for whatever reason that this is a trend, it wasn't a one-off, that we had 135,000. If we see anything under 100,000, all bets are off. Markets are not going to be happy. I think the numbers, the ranges that we'll look for is over 150,000. I think there'll be a sigh of relief. Under 100,000, there's going to be a lot of concern. Probably under 120,000, by the way. But if we do happen to get back on track and we see that over 150,000, again, expectations now are for 185,000 added. So again, that's a pretty big number compared to last month. So that would, if we actually got to that level, I think that everybody would look at last month's as a one-off, I don't know, maybe because of some weather issue or maybe some kind of just crazy, astrostellar, crazy situation that happened that all of a sudden, you know, 1 month was a transitory one-off kind of deal. So look for under 100,000, over 100,000. I think that's what the range is going to be in terms of people being concerned. I think at 135, 140, we'll say, we're staying at about those levels. But that would also start to pique the concern that there's something more going on than just a one-off. So take a look at that. That's going to be going on for next week. Other than that, I'm going to wrap it up here. I'll mention that, of course, as I mentioned earlier, if you do want to ask a question to find out more about what we're doing, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Do me a favor also, tell a friend. Just mention to somebody, hey, have you heard about this Disciplined Investor podcast? Pretty cool stuff. Get it on iTunes or go over the site or find it on Spreaker or wherever else you can get, you know, Google Play for that matter. Wherever else you get your podcast, check this out because this is some great information and can help you in the markets, et cetera. Go over to the site. We'll put all the stock stuff that we mentioned this week, some of their symbols, all the symbols for that matter. We're going to wrap. Thanks for joining me. Have a great 4th of July weekend and a great week ahead. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.